This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Monday, the 23rd of July. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Tom Morgan. Tonight on the show, we explore the ongoing global struggle to combat HIV/AIDS as the 22nd International AIDS Conference kicks off in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. Despite advances in awareness and prevention strategies, such as pre- and post-exposure prophylaxis and research evidence informing the U equals U campaign, 1 million people globally died from AIDS-related illnesses last year, reminding us that the struggles in providing both access and information beyond developed Western countries. We hear from Professor Sharon Lewin, director of the Peter Doherty Institute for Infection and Immunity, as one of the authors of research into the HIV/AIDS response efforts and what needs to be done to avoid the risk of complacency in the approach. We also speak with the CEO of Living Positive Victoria, Richard Keane, on his thoughts on this matter and what still needs to change in the local and international HIV response.
This is The Informer, Joy's nightly news and current affairs program. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS us on 0427 Joy 949, email on air at joy.org.au or add us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
This month marks 4 years since AIDS 2014, the global meeting of doctors, scientists and policymakers, as well as community representatives and advocates here in Melbourne. Together, these leaders committed to a bold and ambitious targets to reduce HIV infections globally and so far as to effectively end AIDS by 2030. Over 9,000 delegates attending from across the world came together here in Melbourne to share the latest news and join in a declaration of nobody left behind in the struggle against HIV/AIDS that all countries would address. Tonight, on the eve of AIDS 2018 meeting in Amsterdam, we hear how much of that optimism has been unfulfilled and the concern that a major shift in approach is needed to meaningfully recorrect. A major report last week, published in the leading medical journal The Lancet, over 40 experts concluded that the response to the HIV/AIDS epidemic globally is at risk of dangerous complacency and that an urgent change in approach is needed. The authors warn that HIV rates persist in high-risk, marginalised populations such as gay and bisexual men and trans people. Ian Muchamore spoke to one of the study authors about what this means for our community. Professor Sharon Lewin is the director of the Peter Doherty Institute for Infection and Immunity here in Melbourne.
This is an important report from the Lancet HIV Commission. Would you say it's a landmark report?
I think it is a really important report, largely because it comes at an important time in the global response. And I think it also offers some really practical solutions to where we go next in our response to the HIV epidemic. And it highlights a number of new strategies that I don't think have been widely discussed in the global community. So I think that probably makes it important, maybe landmark. I'd say landmark if we do see changes as a result of this report. We're yet to see that.
What do you think are the key messages from this report about preventing HIV for LGBTI communities here in Australia and also internationally?
Well, the key messages of this report are really about the global response to HIV and that we're not on track to meet the targets of 2020 to reduce the number of new infections to 500,000 and reduce the number of AIDS-related deaths to 500,000 and to increase uptake of treatment. Australia's situation is very different to the global situation for HIV, where we know that 80% of people living with HIV are in sub-Saharan Africa and the majority are in low- and middle-income countries. The focus of the report is really about how to reach those targets, that we're not on track to reach those targets, and providing some potential solutions to accelerate the response. The report highlights complacency in the global response, a risk of reduced funding now, which could have significant effects for the future of the HIV epidemic. So at the moment, the current costs of the HIV response are estimated to be about $20 billion a year, and about half of that is from international funders and half of that from domestic contributions. And the international funding contribution has decreased about 20% over the last 3 years. And any further decrease in international funding could see a very significant adverse outcome in the HIV response, or the HIV, you know, the numbers of new infections and deaths. And in fact, the estimates are that to really reach our targets by 2020 and eventually by 2030, we really need in the order of $25 billion a year. It's not just around money. There is also a very detailed discussion, as well as some pretty sophisticated modelling in lots of different settings. And some of the benefits of doing that are sort of formally modelled in the report. So I'll give you an example. There was some modelling done around HIV infections in men of sex, men and sex workers in India, and modelling done around if there was integrated packages of screening for sexually transmitted infections, access to treatment, access to PrEP at certain levels. This could lead to a very significant decline in new infections. Something that we in Australia tend to have integrated sexual health services, but globally or in many low-income countries, these services are very siloed. So it's really opening a discussion about how we integrate HIV services better, and also how we can really leverage off some of the great successes of what we did in HIV, which is, you know, very patient-centred response engagement with civil society advocacy around global funding.
The report says that 93 countries globally report that they have HIV-specific programs for gay and bisexual men. That's just about half of all the countries in the world, by my reckoning. And about two-thirds of those countries that do have HIV programs for gay and bisexual men say that they're completely reliant. Those programs are wholly funded by international funding. How important are these programs to continue or expand?
They're absolutely critical, and there's good evidence that you get the best responses when you have that sort of tailored programming to the population of highest risk, and they're, you know, you get the best outcomes with those programs. So seeing them diminish is a real worry, and one of the really important issues that threatens these programs is terrible criminalisation laws that still exist in 70 countries, and we've highlighted that for a long time, but we're not seeing a reduction in the numbers of those countries. If anything, we're seeing worsening, particularly in countries like Russia or Nigeria and Indonesia as well. And anything that criminalises same-sex couples is a big issue for public health, because it means that it creates a climate of fear and therefore less willingness to, or, you know, a real threat to someone to engage with public health prevention messages or even with treatment. So this is, I think, probably one of the biggest issues globally, and it's a really a big issue around civil society and human rights, in fact, and that's probably the biggest threat globally.
So 4 years ago, we were in Melbourne, and you were the co-chair of the AIDS 2014 Congress. What's changed in the last 4 years?
I think in Melbourne, there's a lot that's changed. I think in Melbourne, there was this sense of optimism about where we would get to with HIV, and a lot of discussion around ending AIDS. This was a slogan that was started probably 2 years earlier at the Washington meeting and was the global message. And that may have sent the wrong message, I think. There certainly should be a lot of optimism around the HIV response, given all the new tools we have for treatment and prevention, which are really quite spectacular. But not the real challenge now is implementing those tools and making them accessible to everyone. So we see some countries in which we've had an excellent response, and I would include Australia amongst those, but also in low-income countries like Botswana, Cambodia, and Namibia have all had fantastic programs to increase treatment. But many countries are woefully way behind that. So the real shift has been that we thought the end of AIDS was sort of around the corner back in 2014, and 4 years later, we now see that we don't have the reduction in new infections or AIDS-related deaths or the increase in treatment uptake that we were hoping for to reach by 2020. 2020 is only 2 years away, and we're way off those targets. And I think this report highlights that perhaps some complacency has crept in, and we're now in a serious position unless we increase investment considerably and also think about new and innovative models to respond to HIV, which is tailored to different countries and different populations. So I think that sense of optimism has really shifted, and now there's real concern about the future of funding. On the scientific front, there's been tremendous changes in future of antiviral therapy, the potential role of two drugs versus three drugs, the increasing number of studies we're seeing that long-acting drugs or injectable drugs for treatment and prevention. And in my own area of cure research, I think we probably had a little bit more optimism back in 2014, huge commitment to the need to invest in the science towards finding cure. And probably over the last 4 years, we've learned a hell of a lot about HIV and how it persists on treatment. Quite a number of interventions have been tried, and there's probably reality that this is going to be an extremely tough scientific challenge. It doesn't mean we don't invest and try and do it, but I'd probably a little more realistic view that this is going to be a difficult road.
That was Ian Muchamore with Professor Sharon Lewin from the Peter Doherty Institute here in Melbourne.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
Tonight, we're talking about the local and global challenges of tackling HIV infection rates around the world, particularly when we have set such bold goals to reduce HIV infections globally by 2030. A new report published in The Lancet highlights that communities and services may need to work differently if HIV prevention and care is to become more effective. Richard Keane is the CEO of Living Positive Victoria and speaks with us tonight on The Informer about what still needs to change in the local and international HIV response.
Talking to Sharon, the message seems to be that we're not going to reach the global targets of ending HIV, the 1990 targets, by 2020. We talked a lot at AIDS 2014 in Melbourne about these messages. Do we now need to modify that message?
I think it's an important message to keep striving. I think some of the problems is that these were really bold initiatives that were set to reach these targets, and not impossible to do, but it seems that there's differences in approaches around the globe that end to different results, and I don't think the reach, particularly to countries in the global south, has been effective.
Let's talk about that in a moment, but in Australia, what are we looking like with moving towards ending HIV? You just started a new role, congratulations, as the CEO of Living Positive Victoria. What's your take on where we are at the moment in tackling HIV and ending HIV?
I think we've still got a number of challenges. I think there's some areas where we're being really successful. When we look at biomedical interventions that have developed, we're not only talking about PEP and PrEP, but we're talking about treatment as prevention, and particularly around the U equals U campaign, undetectable equals untransmissible. For the first time people living with HIV are squarely included in the frame of prevention of HIV and forward transmission. So there is a number of areas that we've got a very, very good story to tell. Particularly the partnership models that we've engaged here, particularly in Victoria and more broadly in Australia, the partnership models where people living with HIV have greater and meaningful involvement within those partnerships. And I think we can talk probably a little bit about some of the things that are said in reports that we're talking about now, where they're aiming to have HIV integrated with other health services as being an alternative models to the ones that we've set up here. So the partnership approach is already effective here, and having HIV positive people at the table enables those other partners and those other areas of health to be able to better address the issues of people living with HIV who may also be dealing with multiple other conditions.
What do we need to do in addition to what we're doing? And especially with this theme coming out of the report, which I think applies everywhere, is that we need to come out of some of our silos.
Yes, we do. We need to be engaged around all the issues that affect people living with HIV. But at the same time, HIV has been framed in an exceptional way because it's an exceptional disease. It's an exceptional situation that we have, and it's exceptional because of stigma and discrimination that people living with HIV still endure today, 35 years into the epidemic in this country. I was talking just recently to a group of nurses at a private hospital around disclosure and confidentiality in healthcare settings, and after doing that presentation, it's the conversations you have when you're having your cup of tea and your biscuit with people afterwards, where you hear that although we've set up all of these amazing standards and we work through our national peak, NAPWHA, to set up standards around peer standards, around psychological support standards for adults living with HIV, the best international models that we've got. But when you're actually engaging with people at the coalface, you still hear these stories, like a nurse tell me that her colleague who was pregnant refused to engage with a HIV-positive person because she was fearful for her child. So we've got people in healthcare settings that for all sorts of reasons haven't been able to make that transition across and maybe haven't in their day-to-day roles dealt with a lot of people living with HIV. And so I think, again, it re-emphasises the need to reinforce those partnership models and have HIV-positive people actually engaging in these services to build the health literacy, to build the understanding, and to build an understanding of how stigmatising those types of things can be. Another person told me about the fact that we still have on all the forms when you go in, you've got to tick whether you're hepatitis C or HIV positive, and not many people do that. But when somebody is brave enough and honest enough to tick that box, she was saying that then there was a conversation around that reception desk for 15 minutes because it's something that doesn't really happen a lot, and all of a sudden everyone was discussing protocols and what should be done and what shouldn't be done without realising that that's disclosure and that's breaching confidentiality of a patient. So there's still lots of work to do even here at the grassroots level. And I think positive voice organisations are as important today as they were 30 years ago when we first started. The engagement of people advocating for themselves, which has led to Living Positive Victoria being the organisation it is today.
We're talking about HIV prevention in Australia and internationally. What's the role of organisations which are solely set up to work around HIV, and how do they operate and work with organisations or in this partnership model? How does that actually look? Because the report seems to say that we need to move away from just treating HIV as its own special thing that's completely different to any other aspect of health.
I'm not for a minute implying that we shouldn't be looking at the work we do and modifying that work we do as we go, as responsibilities change and new areas of focus need to be developed. One of the worst things that you can ever hear in any response is that's the way we've always done it. I think part of this partnership model that I was talking about, where we work with research, where we work with clinicians, where we work with healthcare providers, equal at the table and recognised as experts in living with HIV.
We are seeing some perhaps worrying signs, or you may not agree, that people born overseas are still getting HIV, and we're not seeing a drop in the number of infections in gay and bisexual men especially, not the only group affected, but we're seeing a reduction in people who are born in Australia, but we're not seeing a reduction or even an increase in people who are born overseas. Where do HIV organisations like Living Positive Victoria fit in to reaching out? I mean, can you do that on your own, or is this part of this partnership model again?
Again, it's part of the partnership model. We need to be innovative, and we need to be looking at a range of interventions where we can engage. And I know that we keep talking about this partnership model, but the reason that it works so well, this very issue was being discussed earlier last week in a meeting that I was in.
What are the answers? What are the possibilities?
First of all, I think that we need to have these models of care readjusted. We need to look at some of the complex issues of these individuals. Some are coming in on student visas, Medicare ineligibility. There's a lot of things that are making reaching these individuals and engaging them in care complex and problematic. And I can tell you that within that partnership model, people really are aware of this situation and are addressing it as best as they possibly can. But I think that we need to have real focus on somebody stepping up. We earn billions of dollars from international students coming to this state every year. We need to be able to support them and support their health and support their health choices while they're in this country.
That was CEO of Living Positive Victoria, Richard Keane, with Ian Muchamore on the changes in local and international HIV response that are still needed, with more to come.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
This report from The Lancet is essentially about the global issues and the fact that we haven't met the targets for reducing HIV significantly that we were expecting to 4 or 6 years ago. What are your reflections on what the challenges are for LGBTI communities in other countries? Why are we finding it so difficult to make an impact? We know that something like 10% of new infections worldwide are in LGBTI people.
I think our region has some really big issues that we need to try and get around. Criminalisation of people from LGBTI communities means that often if you're going to get tested or you're going to get treatment or anything else and you're identified in that way, it could lead to your life being significantly affected, even more than it is when it's impacted by HIV. I'm talking about within our region. We've seen what's been happening in Indonesia recently in some areas there. We've seen skyrocketing rates of HIV in places like Singapore and the Philippines. And this is going to be a real challenge for us. And I have a little bit of concern, which relates back to our local response here, that if we don't find ways to officially, not just under the table, deal with these situations and muddle something together so we're actually providing these people with support, but have actual proper procedures around how we're going to engage these people and formal processes of how we're going to do it, my concern is that we'll end up with a two-speed response in this country where white privileged gay men like myself have the ability to access treatment and care to the highest standard, to global best practice standard, and we've got this other group of people that are just shuffled around in the background by hook or by crook, making sure that we can give them the services that they need, but without any formal structures around that. My concern is that at AIDS 2014 here, everybody signed the pledge about nobody being left behind, and there's the potential for a whole group of people here to be left behind and remain invisible.
We were very optimistic. I was with you at AIDS 2014 in Melbourne. We were very optimistic about what we could achieve back then. What's changed?
I think there's been a little bit of a pushback, and the whole idea of framing things in the terms of exceptional responses, I think, is problematic. What it does is it makes HIV look like it stands out and gets exceptional treatment or special treatment or better treatment than other diseases, and it doesn't. It gets a relative response, and you look at other chronic illnesses, it is so different than other chronic illnesses. We've talked about criminalisation, we've talked about stigma, we've talked about some of the complex issues that people living with HIV deal with. If that's moved into a healthcare stream, and I'm thinking not only locally, but I'm thinking globally and within our region as well, Ian, one of the issues that I see is where will the transparency be around that money that's allocated for HIV funding within a broader health fund and response context? And so some of these countries have very much competing models. Who's going to follow the transparency of where that money for HIV is going? Who do we know that they're going to shift HIV money into other areas and make decisions around religious or moral frameworks, particularly when it comes to supporting people from LGBTIQ and marginalised background like sex workers and people who inject drugs?
The report says that less than half of the countries in the world have an HIV response which has specific gay and bisexual men programs. Most of those programs are actually funded with international aid money. So are they under threat with this shift to moving in this more integrated way?
Not locally. I think that the history locally is very, very strong, but I'm very, very concerned for our region. I'm very concerned for the global response. And I think part of the reason that we've come to this place where we realise we're not going to reach those boundaries is because we haven't found an effective way to engage countries and to engage communities who have real issues around LGBTIQ identity and engagement. And we haven't found a model that engages those people in a productive way. And I think this is going to be a complex, ongoing issue. And I think, you know, we were all on a bit of a high last year after marriage equality and other things like this, but this is a timely reminder that there's still a lot of work to go. And part of our responsibility as a first world country and as a democracy that engages and enshrines human rights is to try and prosecute that within our region as well, and try and use any means that we can to draw attention to the challenges of criminalisation of these communities.
Once again, that was Ian Muchamore continuing his conversation with Richard Keane, CEO of Living Positive Victoria, about what needs to change at the local and international levels so that our communities are not left behind in the struggle against HIV/AIDS.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.